This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Hope everybody, specifically the moms of the world, had a great Mother's Day and glad you're listening to us. And we start our week on a momentous day in Louisiana history. It was 50 years ago today that Edwin Washington Edwards, the longest serving governor in Louisiana history, he served 16 years as governor of our state, 1972 to 1980, 1984 to 1988, and 1992 to 1996. So 16 of 24 years, the Cajun Prince was large and in charge at the state capitol. And it all began on this date in 1972 when Edwin Washington Edwards took the oath of office, becoming the first Cajun and first Catholic in the 20th century to become Louisiana's leader. He arguably is the most successful politician in Louisiana history. If you asked him, certainly he would tell you that. But he, as we know, fell from grace in the year of 2000, and it was on this date, ironically, 22 years ago, that Edwin Edwards was convicted in federal court on 17 counts of fraud and racketeering that sent him to jail for 8.5 years, largely at Oakdale. At first, he reported to Big Spring, Texas, but he logged 8.5 years at Oakdale, and he, of course, did things in prison that most humans wouldn't. He met his wife, not any wife, a wife 51 years his junior, the beautiful Trina, who was with him until the end. And he was said, as he would only say, that they sent me away for life and I came out with a wife. That was Edwin Edwards. And a man who knew him well, I mean really well, Sam LeBlanc is with us, Sam A. LeBlanc III. He took the oath of office as a state house member on this date 50 years ago. He represented the New Orleans area, Jefferson Parish, graduate of Georgetown and Tulane Law School, and of course, Jesuit High School. And he was there with the Cajun Prince when it all began at the state capitol on this date in the year of 1972. Sam LeBlanc, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning.
Well, if you're on a speakerphone, please get off if you can, because it's not going to work real well with our audience. But if not, we'll go with what we have. But if you can make an adjustment, I sure would appreciate it, because I can tell you sound like you're in a bathroom right now, and I don't think you
are. I got off the speakerphone.
Okay, there we go. That's perfect. Sam LeBlanc, tell us about your association with Edwin Edwards, how you met, and how this friendship that ultimately became a political alliance ensued.
Well, we met actually before the election, because a friend of mine, was a very close friend of mine, Ted LaBorde, was from Marksville, and we wanted to go to the Mardi Gras Ball, which we had in Washington, D.C., which we had gone to every year when we were at Georgetown. Anyways, Edwin gave us tickets. The next thing I know, I'm representing, or actually being a campaign manager for Bennett Johnson against Edwin Edwards when he ran for governor, and I was running at the same time. Anyway, long story short, you know what happened. Bennett got beat by just a few thousand votes. I ended up getting elected. Edwin got elected, and we became friends after that. But he never would let me forget about the way we met and him getting the tickets and me ending up being on Bennett's side in the beginning.
The twists and turns of history are interesting, and quite often they are decided by a few votes. And we saw this last week in Baton Rouge when Brad Myers defeated Jordan Faircloth by 2 votes, meaning that if anybody had changed their mind or voted the other way, it would have been dead even. And in Louisiana, like the nation, I'm going back to the year of 2000, the Supreme Court stopped a recount in Florida, which would have made Albert Gore president most likely. Supreme Court stepped in. They weren't in favor of state rights then. They said, no way, Florida. And we got George Bush. Imagine how the world would have changed. And Bennett Johnston, absolutely, in 1971, as you noted, he was within 4,422 votes of defeating Edwin Edwards in a runoff. That was a razor-tight race. It's closer than the Landrieu Jenkins race. And as we know, when you lose a close one, sometimes that's much harder. I think every time it's much harder than when you lose by a rout. And Bennett Johnston, according to his good friend and associate Tommy Hudson, has spent much of his life wondering what might have happened. And he would have been a different type governor. He, of course, was a champion of industry, but he would not have been as colorful as Edwin Edwards. There was nobody quite like Edwin, was there?
Nobody. Edwin was as colorful a guy as you could get, and smart as a whip.
What made him so unique?
I think it's where he came from. He came from nowhere. He was a poor boy. He had nothing to begin with. You know, he was really kind of a sharecropper family type. And he just was smart, and he had ambition, which was unbelievable. And he just was able to catch on. He was just so fast, Jim, that he could catch on to almost anything.
Now, he used the power of the governor's office, and it's immense in Louisiana, to his advantage. But Edwin Edwards would rib and ridicule and sometimes publicly humiliate political foes. But he ultimately didn't carry many, if any, grudges, Clyde Vidreen perhaps being the only one. But he had a way of talking with anybody. Anybody had an audience with Governor Edwards if they wanted it.
He gave audiences to almost anybody, and he would never talk down to people. He would make fun of people, but he would never talk down to you, ever.
What was it like at the Capitol on this date in 1972 when you were becoming a state lawmaker and Edwin Edwards was succeeding John McKithen as governor of Louisiana?
Everything was new, Jim. Everything was new. First of all, the two people who got into the runoff, Edwin Edwards and Bennett Johnson, were guys that they never suspected were going to get into office, okay? And the legislature was totally changed because, if you recall, just before the legislature met for that first time, the courts had declared one-to-one vote rule was violated. And so Ed Stimel had prepared a new representative in Senate districts. There were single-member districts for the first time. In fact, I represented not only Orleans Parish, but part of Jefferson Parish, part of Orleans and part of Jefferson, which had never happened before. So it was totally new in every single way. And it was a time in which the good government groups like PAR wanted to do lots of substantial changes to the state. It was exciting. It was new. And everybody was full of energy and ready to go.
Well, you were a young man. You were a decade younger than Edwin Edwards, and he was a young man. Many yes. of a certain age probably have a hard time remembering Edwin Edwards when he was young, but he was born in 1927. So when he took the oath of office, he was all of 44 years old. And he was a dashing figure and saturated with charisma. Did he give a stirring address that day?
He did. And of course, he could have almost said anything. It would have been a stirring address. But in any event, he gave us a stirring address because it was about Louisiana and the changes we were going to make in the future. It was great.
Well, and he followed through, the Constitution being the major change. Was that a heavy lift, or did it come easy for him?
It was a very heavy lift for him because of the way it was structured. And fortunately, you had good people in there, like my good buddy Bubba Henry, who had been in the legislature before, who came up with some really good ideas to satisfy everyone. I think everyone was afraid of this. To be honest with you, there were lots of bills in that first legislative session that he was not exactly for to begin with. Okay, and he knew where the wind was blowing, and he supported some of them. I mean, we had things like central cash management. We had things like taking the lobbyists off the floor of the legislature, which was brand new and startlingly new.
All right, so you're fading a bit on us, Sam. You're fading a little bit, but you say that Edwin Edwards was responsible for lobbyists not being on the floor?
No, I'm saying that we had a lot of new things coming up. And what I'm saying is that Edwin Edwards wasn't for a lot of these new things, like the lobbyists not being on the floor.
I got you. I thought so, yeah. Yeah,
Victor Busey was absolutely against it, and we had a hard fought. But Edwin could see what was going to happen, and when he saw what was going to happen, he would get onto the team. He didn't lead a lot of these things, but when he could see that it was going to happen and should happen, he got on after that.
Now, even some of his supporters say Edwin was corrupt, competent but corrupt. Is that fair?
You know, I never experienced that with Edwin, and I was not in Edwin's inner group, okay? I was sort of another group, so to speak. In fact, I got named by Sonny Mouton as Good Government Sam. And I was a kind of a good government groupie. And it was sort of a, if you recall, before Edwin got elected, the big thing was the Young Turks. And there was some still Young Turks left over in the first administration of Edwin Edwards. And we sort of formed a group that was for good government. And basically what I'm saying is that he didn't always come out front at first on some of these things. But when he saw it was going to be good for the state and he saw it was going to pass, then, of course, he got on the bandwagon.
Sam LeBlanc with us for a few more minutes, 877-217-5757, and talk@talklouisiana.org is your number. It was 50 years ago today that Edwin Edwards took the oath of office as governor of Louisiana, age 44. 22 years ago today, when he was 72, he was convicted in federal court. We'll talk more. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing. A few more minutes with Samuel LeBlanc III. He studied at Georgetown, graduated 1963, doctorate from Tulane Law School, as had his grandfather achieved. And years later, Sam received a Master's of Law in Tulane in Energy and Environmental Law. On the 50th anniversary of his graduation from law school, LeBlanc was cited with an Outstanding Alumni Award by the Tulane Alumni Association. And 50 years ago today, he took the oath as a young state lawmaker, House member representing parts of Jefferson and Orleans, went to high school at Jesuit High. And when he ran for the state legislature, his half-brother Rob Kuig was his campaign manager. So he has a rich history in Louisiana lore, Sam LeBlanc. And the story that perhaps is sexier than anything we've talked about to this point, Sam, is that you, in a way, and maybe more than a way, were responsible for Edwin Edwards retiring a pretty big campaign debt in 1983 by going to Paris in 1984 with 600 of his closest friends, including Mary Landrieu and John Brough and Bennett Johnston. They were all there, weren't they?
Absolutely. He had a wonderful trip.
But you know, many of these people were nowhere to be found when Edwin got in trouble, but there they were partying in Paris with him, weren't they?
Well, you know, he had been elected governor, and everybody who wants to be close to the governor got on that trip. I mean, there were, you know, $10,000 a pop, okay?
$10,000 in 1984, yeah. Yeah, that's a lot of money, 1984.
But as I told you, Jim, to be honest with you, now, I don't like to even think about it because you can only do great things one time, they say, and you can't go back home again. Well, look, I had put that together for the State Bar Association the year before. In April of 1983, the State Bar Association had its first conference outside of the country. We went to Paris, France, had a wonderful conference there. But in addition to that, I put together this dinner at Versailles, which was fabulous, absolutely fabulous. Then subsequently helped Edwin get elected by being a statewide coordinator. And when we had this $14 million debt from the campaign, I was a $4 million debt, we were thinking about ideas to try and recoup that money. And I happened to mention this to Marion Edwards, who of course was the governor's brother, and Marion took it over and did the whole thing again. He even copied the invitations that we had from the year before.
And it worked. Did it ever?
And it worked. Oh, did it work? I mean, we got a little Peace and Time magazine on that, if you remember.
Oh yeah, it got national play, and it was brilliant, no doubt about it. Everybody had a good time, and of course, everybody wanted to be near the Cajun Prince then. But as we know, not so long later, about 16 years. Outside that federal courthouse, he was a man alone. Now, a listener asked which wife was with him in Paris. It was Elaine. She was his wife,
was the
first
absolutely,
lady.
Absolutely.
It was Elaine Edwards. She was there. Barry in Mid-City. Barry, you're on with Sam LeBlanc.
Good morning. I want to reflect on the meeting that we had during the Edwards-Duke campaign for governor within Legacy Congregation B'nai Israel, a private meeting closed to the press. And we worked very hard along with the Coalition Against Racism and Nazism that many of us and others formed to defeat David Duke. A very memorable moment in the life of the late Governor Edwards.
Well, Edwin Edwards, of course, was elected that year, remember? Elect the crook, it's
important.
Remember
the bumper sticker, Jim?
I do. Now, a listener's taking a little bit of a jab at Barry here, saying you know, quite often on this show, and he's right. He's right. Tracy at the Capitol's right. We take shots at conservative ministers who inject themselves into politics and get tax exemptions. Well, that should, you know, what's fair for the goose is fair for the gander. Barry, I love you, and Barry will be with us Friday if things go according to plan, but the rabbi should not have been involved in politics. Even as something as sinister as that, that's not a good thing, Rabbi Weinstein, but you got the job done, and I think Louisiana's better for it. And thank God for our black citizens. Without them, David Ernest Duke would have been U.S. Senator David Ernest Duke and Governor David Ernest Duke. And without black folks, of course, we would have had Governor David Bruce Vitter as well. But Sam LeBlanc, you've decided to come home to St. Francisville. That's quite a voyage from New Orleans. Why so?
Well, I stayed in New Orleans. I stayed in New Orleans until I retired. I retired from my law firm, and then my wife and I joined the Peace Corps and went to Romania. And it was after that we came home right in time for Katrina. And it was after Katrina that we moved to St. Francisville.
Well, I guess you like it.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's a beautiful place up here.
It is beautiful. But New Orleans isn't bad either. And a lot of people like you are New Orleans true and true. You got legacy there with family members. No way many of them would leave the Crescent City, but you opted to do so.
Got older, Jim. New Orleans is a great city and always will be.
It is a great city. It is the crown jewel of Louisiana, and we should all be cognizant of that as we appreciate New Orleans. We talk a lot about the problems there, but on the whole, it is something that needs to be treasured. And Edwin Edwards, a listener, notes he's responsible for Tom Benson buying the Saints. And because of that, the Saints have stayed in New Orleans. And perhaps that is his signature achievement, one that is largely ignored.
Absolutely.
Without the Saints, what would New Orleans be like?
Not what it is today. Who that say going to beat them Saints?
Well, Sam, you are a survivor. Edwin Edwards is gone. I suspect most of your contemporaries in the legislature are as well. Then we didn't have term limits. You came in with John Alario. And by the way, I saw another nice photo of John and Trina together, a wonderful couple. Your thoughts about the guys you came in with and those who are still around, like Speaker and Senate President Alario?
Well, let me say about John for the first thing. John Alario was one of the finest politicians that this state has ever had. And you notice, Jim, he's never been in any trouble. He's never been tarred by a bad brush of anything. John did a fabulous job wherever he was. He stayed in politics a long time. He served the state very well. I think there are other people. I mentioned to my good buddy Bubba Henry did a fabulous job as a Speaker of the House and ran for governor, didn't win, worked with David Treen, and then he did a great thing. He came with my law firm. So he did a great job. There were really some really good people, and we didn't have that poisonous atmosphere that they seem to have now, Jim. I don't understand it. We had really tough bills that we worked against each other on, but we never, never treated each other like.
Who were some of the most memorable characters, Sam, that you were with in the legislature? Did we lose Sam? Okay, I think we've lost him. If you can unlock him. I see he's still there, Robin, but he's not coming through. But at any rate, a fascinating gentleman, and we're kind of happy that he's in this area. Lots of wisdom in those years from the man from Jesuit High School. He's quite proud of his alma mater, and, of course, he went to Tulane, too, in Louisiana, as we know. Some folks in this area don't particularly care for that, but that grudge has now gone away, largely because LSU doesn't play Tulane anymore. And what a shame. What a shame. LSU opening its season in the Superdome, it would be very nice if they continued to play the home and away against Tulane. But Brian Kelly will make his debut September 4th at the Louisiana Superdome against the Greenies. And then come September 10th, one of the big events in Louisiana history will happen as LSU plays Southern University. My friend Steve Miley says the Human Jukebox will be performing at Tiger Stadium. So the Southern Band and the LSU Band will be on the same field, and it will be quite a spectacle. But many of these things we're talking about, certainly the Superdome, the Smoothie King Center, They happened under the watch of Edwin Washington Edwards. He was a flawed man, as we all are, but he was inaugurated on this date 50 years ago. Another listener notes that 6 days after that, George Wallace, his contemporary at in Alabama, was shot and almost killed in Laurel, Maryland. But Edwin Edwards came in at the time where the South was changing. He brought a lot of blacks into state government. Good move. But he was preceded in 1970 by a progressive and Dale Bumpers in Arkansas, and a guy in 1970 in Georgia named James Earl Carter, who for the time was progressive. After all, he succeeded Lester Maddox. But Jimmy Carter, even Jimmy Carter, the progressive Jimmy Carter, allowed the Confederate flag to fly over the Georgia Capitol for 4 years. Sam LeBlanc, thank you very much. Sorry we couldn't get you at the end, but good remarks, and we'll be in touch. And we'll return after this to talk some about the markets. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We turn the page, and we're joined now by Lev Manand. His latest book is The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. We're talking about how the Fed is acting with inflation being out of control. The Fed can't fix our broken banking system is the contention by Mr. Manand, and he has a point that many are uttering. And of course, today we are seeing the markets tumble some more. It's not a good time to be invested in the stock market. As we know, things often change in a hurry, but at this point, the Dow's down 482 points. It's off more than 1%, and the NASDAQ is down more than 2%. So we shall see, but some believe we have some systemic issues that should be addressed in a different or better way, and one of them is our guest. His latest work, Lev Manand, is The Fed Unbound. And good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to talk with you. Why do you believe the Fed's on the wrong track?
So I basically think that we have an underlying problem in the U.S. economy and financial system, and it's the erosion of the banking system and the monopoly that banks have long had on creating money, creating deposits, which most people use as money, and the rise of something called shadow banking, which is sort of non-banks copying that business model. And this is what blew up in 2008, led to a huge financial crisis and a huge recession. The Fed has basically been fighting to prevent that from happening again ever since 2008. And this is the world we're living in right now. And so when we're thinking about inflation numbers we're seeing and we're thinking about the fragility of our markets, it all goes back to 2008 and the underlying systemic problems that caused 2008 and that have not been fixed since then.
877-217-5757. Lev Manand is an associate professor of law at Columbia. He served as senior advisor to the Secretary of Treasury from 2015 to 2016, senior advisor to the Assistant Secretary for Financial Institutions in 2014 and in 2015. He lives in the center of the action in New York City. Is there some wariness right now on Wall Street and beyond?
I think there's a good deal of wariness. The Fed just last week announced that it was going to start shrinking its balance sheet. Its balance sheet is now $9 trillion large. That's something that's happened all since 2008. And the question is, will the Fed be able to do that without precipitating another crisis like 2008? Is the underlying financial system stable enough to allow the Fed to remove its accommodation? And people aren't sure about that. And we could find ourselves in the next 6 months to a year facing another crisis like the one we saw in 2008.
The interest rates were raised by half a point last week. They have been historically low. Is that a prudent move by the Fed?
I think that the raising of the overnight interest rate was prudent and was necessary. But the Fed has a larger problem, which has to do with its balance sheet. One of the things that happened beginning in 2008 is it, in addition to adjusting overnight interest rates, which is its traditional role, it began to purchase assets outright. It went into the market and bought treasury securities and agency-backed, mortgage-backed securities, and it accumulated trillions of dollars worth of them. And now the Fed is trying to unwind that. And the issue is, will the markets be able to absorb that shift? And will our financial system be able to adjust to an environment of higher interest rates? And the Fed is hoping that it will, because it has an inflation number that has gone well above its target. At the same time, it's not clear that the system is resilient and can continue to function without all of this Fed support.
The book is The Fed Unbound, from Lev Manand, a high-ranking Treasury official himself for many years. Now, were your ideas embraced when you were in the inner sanctum, or were you viewed as an outlier, Lev?
I would say that my concerns about the underlying structure of the system have emerged since I left the government. And during one period in particular that I became very concerned, and this was in 2020 when the pandemic hit. And most Americans in March of 2020, April of 2020, were focused on the public health crisis. There was a new, coronavirus. We didn't have a vaccine. We didn't know how to treat it. And that was the sort of focus of much media attention. But on Wall Street, there was a massive panic in the financial markets that was something no one would have expected just because there was a public health crisis. It was a run on financial institutions, and it was a run that jeopardized the continuing functioning of our financial system in a way that was just irrational, not connected to the underlying economic dislocations. And the Fed was able to prevent that run, that financial crisis, from turning into basically a second Great Depression. But it took trillions of dollars of support for the financial sector in March and April of 2020. It was a massive response from the Fed. And it was watching that made me realize that our current situation is unsustainable, and we need fundamental reform to the financial system.
Now, Howland Monroe asks about, and I think this is what you're referring to, this concept of shadow banks. Is that the real culprit?
Yes.
Why?
So this is also something most Americans don't think about, because most Americans use chartered banks. You know, you have an account at Bank of America, and it has a balance, $10,000, and you treat that the same as physical cash. There's not actually physical cash to back that. It's its own form of money. That's how the system is designed to work, and that's how what most Americans use. But over the last several decades, large institutional investors, businesses, financial firms have stopped using predominantly bank deposits, and they started to use alternative instruments that are created by shadow banks, firms that don't have charters to issue deposits. And they have various technical names. They're formally trying to be distinct for legal purposes from a bank deposit, but they function the same way, except they don't have deposit insurance. They don't have the regulatory requirements that go along with deposits. And so you have trillions of dollars worth of basically shadow deposits, deposit alternatives that are not regulated like deposits, but that are and that are accordingly very vulnerable to sort of these run dynamics that we used to have all the time in the 19th century. And we had in 1933 when we had the Great Depression. But we tried to solve that problem by regulating the banking system. And now we have this sort of unregulated shadow system that has cropped up and undermined all of those solutions.
Another listener, Tom on Bluebonnet, asked about cryptocurrency. Are you a fan?
So I'm also concerned about cryptocurrency, in particular, a type of cryptocurrency called stablecoin or stable value coins. These are basically another type of shadow banking. A stablecoin functions a lot like a deposit. It's designed to maintain equivalency with physical cash that's issued by the government, but it's not backed by actual physical cash. It's backed by other instruments in certain cases. So my view is that we need to have stable coins. If we're going to have stable coins, they should always be backed by actual cash one for one. And when they're not, then there's an instability that's being introduced. And what you could have as soon as later this year is possibly a run on stable coins where people try to redeem their stable coins and the issuers mm-hmm. can't come up with cash, just like in the 19th century we used to see all the time in the banking system.
The book again is The Fed Unbound, the subtitle Central Banking in a Time of Crisis, from Lev Menand, who is a professor of law at Columbia. Kirkus says it's a clear and cogent assessment of how the nation's central bank might be reformed. What can be done in the short term, right now?
So, unfortunately, we really need action from Congress. And Congress has been dithering on reforming the financial system and has not done what is necessary to help the Fed do its job. And so I'm loath to suggest there's an easy fix that doesn't involve Congress. Congress, though, the legislation that Congress needs to do could be fairly simple. Something as simple as requiring that any firm engaged in the functional equivalent of banking, issuing an instrument that is designed to maintain mm-hmm. par, to be equivalent to cash over time, anybody doing that has to follow bank regulations. To rationalize the financial regulatory system so that everybody doing a banking business is following the same set of rules. And you could write that in actually, and there are some law professors who have drafted legislation that would do this. Something as simple as that would go a long way towards removing the instability in the financial system.
Hold tight, Lev. Walter in South Baton Rouge has been waiting for a little while. I want to get him in before the break. Walter, you're on with Lev.
Lev, I appreciate the effort here to try to educate. I recently read a report about the Fed buying back a large amount of derivatives from some of the major banks. I thought Dodd-Frank eliminated that possibility.
All right. Lev, would you respond?
So, yeah, great question. So what Dodd-Frank did was it changed the rules for what derivatives what chartered banks can do with derivatives.
All right, hold tight. We're going to take a short break, and we'll get the complete response to Walter's question from Lev Menand. His book is The Fed Unbound. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us. A few more minutes with Lev Menand, former high-ranking Treasury official, professor of law, Columbia. His book is The Fed Unbound. He believes that we're potentially headed for some dark times, and they're already turbulent on Wall Street. And before we hit the break, Walter in South Downs asked about the Fed buying back derivatives. Is that a real problem?
So I think part of Walter's question that I didn't answer was about Dodd-Frank and what was called swaps pushout, which was a part of Dodd-Frank that prohibited banks from engaging in derivatives. And the short answer to Walt's question is that was actually later repealed. So banks are still allowed to engage in derivatives. I'm not aware of a program right now where the Fed is buying back any derivatives from the bank. So I would need to ask Walter a follow-up on that. But the part about Dodd-Frank, that was actually later changed, which was in my view a bad change. But also a longer conversation.
Well, we look forward to following this with you, Lev, and thanks for your time today. And the book is Fed Unbound. Take care, my friend.
Thank you so much.
We're joined now for a few moments by Wade Rouse. He's a USA Today and internationally best-selling author of 13 books, including 4 memoirs and 9 novels. His books have been translated into 21 languages. And he is back in a huge way with Magic Season, A Sun Story. And it is, according to Jenny Lawson, the New York Times bestselling author, honest, authentic, heartbreaking, and healing. It's about finding solace with a dying father through a shared love of baseball. And Wade, that's one of the great things about the national pastime. Sometimes it brings people together, and this is a poignant story. Tell us more.
And thanks for having me, Jim. I appreciate it. Yeah, this is, as you know, I think sports is one of the greatest uniters of all of us. And this is a very deeply personal but life-affirming memoir that follows my relationships with my Ozarks father. I was born and raised in southern Missouri. And it, you know, it goes inning by inning over the very last game that we ever watched together and, you know, through our relationship as well. And really, you know, inning by inning shows how we bridged our gaps and how we were able to take a seat by one another on the couch or at a ball game. And, you know, through our shared love of baseball and talking about our love of the St. Louis Cardinals, we were able to share more of our own life. And I think, you know, as we approach Father's Day, I think any parent-child relationship, you know, this is a very life-affirming book.
The game was, what, 7 years ago?
It was, yeah. You know, the very last game that I ever watched with my father was game four of the St. Louis Cardinals Chicago Cubs. And if you know, if you're from our area, you know how heated that rivalry is. And it was actually the very first time the Chicago Cubs beat the Cardinals to win a division series at Wrigley Field. And, you know, it was just seemed like it all led up to that final game for the two of us. You know, really, my dad and I were bonded by a great sense of humor and our love of the Cardinals, but, you know, often didn't see eye to eye on a lot of things. And this was a chance for us to really bridge that gap. You know, I kind of waited for a walk-off home run in the bottom of the ninth inning, and I was able to achieve that with him thanks to, you know, thanks to sports bringing us together.
Well, you have talked around this a little bit, but you're of course, different than your conservative father, and he didn't like it, I don't think, but baseball brought you together and helped bridge the differences. You loved each other, and October of 2015 was a magical time for you, but I suspect there were some tough times before then.
Oh, yeah, you know, and again, I don't mean to walk around it. You know, I was born and raised in the Ozarks in the 60s and 70s, and, you know, it was not an easy time for me, especially, you know, knowing that I was gay and that my father would not approve. More so, I lost my brother when I was 13, and he was 17 years old, and I really felt like, you know, to be quite honest, that God had taken the wrong person. And that I would never be able to give my father what he dreamed of having, you know, which was a family and a wife. And my dad, you know, tried to teach me. He grew up, you know, his parents were born and raised in the Depression, and he tried to teach me the fundamentals. I always say the farm system of what the Cardinals had. My father had a farm system, and I just wanted to please my dad. And I will say this, you know, my father. My mother was a hospice nurse, and she taught me not to live with regret and to model unconditional love, which is so hard, you know, love without condition. And that's what I tried to do with my father. And my dad taught me, just like a bad team that turns into a great one, the incredible transformational people have if you stick by them, if you love them, mm-hmm. and if you provide unconditional love. And you know, our relationship, I think, is truly ended up being a model for others that you can make it through differences and love each other deeply and personally. And, you know, I always say this is a memoir about the collective history of baseball, but really it's about the collective history of, you know, what we all seek most in our deepest relationships. And that's love and acceptance.
The book is Magic Season, A Son's Story from Wade Rouse. Quote from Yogi Berra starts the book, love is the most important thing in the world, but baseball's pretty good too. And of course, Joe Garagiola and Yogi Berra grew up together on the hill in St. Louis. And of course, we know Yogi had his witticism, sometimes unintended, but that's a very good quote. Very good.
You know, it really does sum it up. And you, thank you for knowing, you've got your great baseball history down. You know, I grew up in a tiny little town in the Ozarks, but I spent my childhood summers at a log cabin that my grandpa Rouse built in the middle of nowhere. And it, you know, it had no indoor bathroom, outhouse. We bathed in the creek, no TV, no telephone, but it did have a radio. And that, you know, it, the only stations I remember that radio receiving are a gospel station and KMOX radio out of St. Louis. And, you know, Jack Buck's voice filled our cabin for decades. And my grandpa was a Cardinals fan. My dad became one and I became one as well. And, you know, I mean, the power of radio, especially growing up and still today, that, you know, that ability like your voice that connects us all, just, you know, it resonates in our souls forever.
Well, I grew up 10 years in Little Rock. And even when I was in New Orleans, I could pick up KMOX. I used to listen to Harry Carey and Jack Buck. And Harry, of course, had an affair with the boss's wife that got him a ticket out of St. Louis. But Jack took control, and my mother said accurately that the voice I heard most in my childhood was that of Jack Buck. He did 162 games a year. People may not know it who are not from that area, but on KMOX, he was also sports director, and when baseball wasn't in season, he talked about baseball nightly on a sports talk show that was ahead of its time. So he was a big part of my youth, and it was soothing to hear him. And you know, I was thinking the other day, he never talked politics, never said anything about politics, which may be a good thing for a play-by-play guy. And it may explain how baseball brought your father and you together in a profound way like no other entity could.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And it's just beautifully stated. You know, Jack had the pleasure of meeting him. I had the pleasure of interviewing his son, Joe Buck, as well. And I think you're exactly right. You know, he really focused on sports and the Cardinals, things that united us rather than divided. And that's what baseball did with my father and I. You know, for many years, we just talked about Lou Brock and Al Hrabowski and Tommy Herr and Keith Hernandez. And slowly, you know, when he'd pat the couch and I'd take a seat, those dots began to be connected, and we started to started to talk about our own lives. You know, whenever I write nonfiction, I never seek to blame. What I try to do is seek to understand how and why we came to be the people we are. You know, and we're all conflicted human beings. And I wanted to understand how my dad became the person he did and how I became the person I did. And I believe you can choose to walk away or you can choose to take a seat. And that's what I did. And, you know, baseball really did do that. And, you know, I would say up until Jack Buck's final years, I would always even turn off the TV. They were Cardinals were on TV. I'd turn off the announcers on TV and listen to Jack broadcast the game as I watched it.
He was one of a kind. And I'm impressed that you mentioned Al Hrabowski. When I was living in Little Rock, he pitched for the Arkansas Travelers for 3 years as a starter, and he was not that good. And then they made him a reliever, and he became the Mad Hungarian. He was sensational for a couple of years. Remember, it's 75, 13-3 with 22 saves for Al Hrabowski, and he was a character. When baseball produces an abundance of them, that's one another wonderful thing about the game.
You know, that's exactly it. And he became a great announcer as well. And it's funny because in this book, it goes inning by inning, but the innings are kind of rooted in Cardinals and baseball and family history. And one of the innings I have is, you know, big characters. You know, my mother was a huge personality. My father was.
Well, we do have to roll, but it is a fantastic book and a poignant story, not sappy, but poignant. Magic Season, A Son Story from Wade Rouse. Signature support for Talk Louisiana from First Financial Tax and Accounting and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. And as the Jack Buck would say, thanks for your time this time. Till next time, so long.